Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Copernic Global Investors second quarter 2021 conference call. As a reminder, today's call is being recorded. At the conclusion of today's presentation, there will be a question and answer session. Instructions will be given at that time. I would now like to turn the call over to Kazem Ghaffar. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, operator, and welcome to the second quarter 2021 conference call. My name is Kazem Ghaffar, and I have with me Dave Ivan, our CIO and Portfolio Manager for the Copernic Global All-Cap Strategy and Co-PM for the International Strategy, and also Alisa Cochran, our Director of Research and Analyst. Before I pass the call to Dave and Alisa, I'll be providing a quick firm update. The firm ended the second quarter with overall firm assets of roughly $6.9 billion. This was a nice increase over the last three months, where our assets grew by roughly $700 million over this period. This increase was due to strong inflows and market appreciation. This also has been our ninth consecutive year of being net positive from an inflow standpoint, and we sincerely appreciate the trust bestowed by our clients. Moving along on the personnel side, no changes to report, and we ended the quarter being 42 employees strong and continue to be stable with minimal turnover since inception of the firm. That brings an end to the business update. Please note, Dave and Alisa will be referring to the presentation, which can be found on our website, copernicglobal.com, under the News and View section. Also, we do have some new content, including Dave's most recent letter. We encourage everyone to have a look after this call or at your convenience. With that, I'll pass it over to Dave and Alisa. Dave, please go ahead.
All right. Thank you, Kazem, and thanks to everybody for tuning in. Nice summer day, and not exactly a value market anymore, so we appreciate you dialing in, but we do think it is a good time for value. As Kazem mentioned, we recently sent out a commentary titled "29 Palms," using a desert theme to talk about exactly what is value and what is money, and what that all means from an investment standpoint. We think it's an important thing, so we're sticking with that theme. It's hard to talk about value and what things are worth without talking about what the meaning of money is and what it means when $4 trillion are printed out of thin air. We'd like to talk a little bit about how that is. The Fed right that it's transitory? Or was Richard Cantillon right years ago when he said it migrates from one thing to another like water in a stream? We obviously think it's the latter. At any rate, though, it should be top of everybody's mind. Is it transitory? Is it migratory? What does that mean, and how can investors take advantage of that? Transitory, of course, means fleeting, momentarily. The Fed wants us to believe that this money they put in the system is momentarily. Yet, let's investigate whether that's true, whether it's migratory, the money moves from one area to another. The next slide, this shows money supply, which by most classical definitions is inflation. Printing more money by definition is inflation. The other things people look at tend to be symptoms. We can see here, going back a lot of years, there were brief periods of time where the money came down, but the trend is up, and we can go back to 1913 when the Federal Reserve started. The trend is always up. The Federal Reserve's history suggests that it's not transitory. They're printing money, printing inflation. The next page is probably a look at future inflation, and this is the amount of debt that's been built up over the years, and especially recently. Debt, of course, is claims on future currency. Therefore, either the debt gets defaulted on or the future currency needs to be materialized, i.e., future printing of money. The next page shows in a nutshell that it's not just a U.S. problem, this is a global problem. This is not just the amount of debt, this is the amount of debt relative to GDP. Across the world, debt is growing way faster than the economy's ability to service that debt. On to the next page, and this is what the commentary explores and what we would like to explore more. print money, does that print wealth, or does that print the illusion of wealth? Has society become richer, or do they just feel richer, or does money just migrate from the poor to those of us that can afford assets? That's the question. If we go to the next page, looking back, and this is over a period longer than my lifetime, you can see prices go up. Owning assets has been a good thing. The price of housing has gone up. The price of drugs has gone up. The price of education has gone up. CPI in general has gone up, but not as fast as real inflation. Moving to the next page, inflation's been everywhere over the long term, but when money is printed, it goes into assets first. You can see on the upper left, we had a bubble in the 70s, we had a bubble in the 90s, we've got what appears to be a bubble now, and the price and the value of stocks has gone to the moon. That's typical. Prices tend to go first into assets and into the valuations of assets. That stocks, the next page, this shows the very longest bonds you could really find out there because they're the ones that are most affected by interest rates and money printing. But you can see when they announced a year and a half ago that they were going to print $4 trillion out of thin air and roughly double the money supply, the price of these bonds doubled. In a few short months, the price of these bonds doubled. Not a coincidence. If you go to the next page, this shows a lot of things. This just shows why assets have been going up quite a bit for recent decades, but it is starting to migrate into other things. You've all seen it at the grocery store. You've seen it in the commodity markets. You've seen it in the real estate markets. This shows a lot of things are at the highest price ever. The next page shows the same thing. And also, there were two or three other pages that I chose not to print. If we move on to page 17, all right, prices have gone up, but the whole point of what we're talking about, looks like we're a few pages behind, page 17, the prices of things go up, but not equally. They go into assets first, and then unless people are willing to allow the price of the assets to go down, which doesn't seem to be any central bank's idea, eventually it migrates into other things. But we are at that point where the price of assets have left the underlying fundamentals in the dust. This should be clear to everybody. It's not sustainable. Prices of assets must come down, or prices of daily living must go up. Central banks want the latter. We suspect they will succeed. The upper left shows the price of stocks relative to the price of labor. To the right, the price of housing relative to the economy that needs to support that housing. The lower right, you can see stocks relative to the earnings. It should be clear. The price relative to earnings cannot go up forever. The next page is even scarier, possibly. This is the price of housing relative to the rent that supports that housing. In New Zealand, 200-something times rent. Interest rates really can't go low enough to support something like that. Even the U.S. with 123 times earnings, if you will, or revenues maybe, because there's usually costs associated. So we're at that point in the cycle where we have had a massive run since bailout QE1. We've had such a massive run in the price of stocks and bonds and real estate since 2008. The underlying fundamentals have been left way behind. We'll come back to that later. The underlying things that need to support that are probably underpriced. Next page, things have become untethered from the underlying fundamentals, but often when you print massive amounts of money, and certainly the last couple of years has been massive amount of money, you get you get speculation, you get mania, you get things going from untethered to unhinged. We were all shocked to see bonds go to a negative real rate of interest, sometimes negative nominal. But this is junk bonds. Junk bonds now yield less than the rate of inflation, meaning you make a dicey loan to somebody or some company. If everything goes well, they pay you back less than you gave them in real terms. That's winning. And losing is they don't pay you back. So things are crazy. The next page, you can see people paying over $1 million for a single pixel of digital art, which meant they paid for a colored square. People are buying digital housing. Good luck living in a digital house. I think you guys have all seen the invisible sculpture that went for a lot of money. So we're in the speculative part of the market. And as an active investor, we say, bring it on. When things get too expensive and everything gets too cheap, that's where active managers are sowing the seeds for future success. The next page, continuing on people doing silly things. Famously, the owners of businesses bought back their own stocks in 1999 before the crash, and in 2007 before the crash, at record levels in 2019 before the mini crash of a year and a half ago. Then notice they stopped buying when their stocks got cheap. Now that their stocks are back to the highest levels of all time, they're buying again. Something to pay attention to. The next page, in a market like this, caution is of order. This page shows caution is the last thing on people's minds. Nobody wants put options. Nobody wants protection against downdrafts. They've already forgotten a year and a quarter ago that downdrafts can even happen. They all want call options. They want to bet on onward and upward. It's worked for a long time. Continuing on the psychology of the market, this page here shows that people are buying stocks without doing any research. This is a strategy that works very well when markets are cheap and fairly efficient and everybody's doing active analysis. They keep the market semi-efficient. Indexing, passive investing makes a lot of sense. Payload fees, payload transaction, get the free ride on a semi-efficient market. But in the 1920s, the 1970s, 1990s, and now, when the market's gone up for a long time, people get rewarded for not doing analysis, and people stop doing analysis. They get carried away with buying the index funds. We believe we're there. We believe the valuation difference between the big popular index stocks and the sort of stocks that we'll talk about later are huge. The next page shows the same thing, but we find it interesting. Howard Marks, who we respect a lot, he wrote a piece 4 years ago telling people who knows what the market's going to do, but caution's in order. There's a lot of crazy things going on, and the amount of valuations and the amount of value agnostic funds has gotten to a scary part. There's many, many pages that show the things he was concerned about 4 years ago. This is just one of many pages that show what seemed scary 4 years ago seems almost tame compared to the excesses in this market. If we move to the next page. This is, I think, the height of excess from anything certainly I've seen in my 40-year career or even read about going back ancient history. So things to worry about. Bonds on the next page. Jim Grant for a long time has referred to bonds as return-free risk. Of course, they've just kept going up and up and up. Now they really are return-free risk. You can see that current rates, and rates are actually lower because we put this together a week ago, current rates are less than the CPI. So right now, we have a negative return, negative real return on what people believe the inflation rate is. Now, we all know inflation's a lot higher than the CPI, so the real rates are actually way worse. So right now, people have the tough position of how do we meet our clients' needs when if we buy bonds, we're guaranteed to lose money if we hold to maturity. And that's compared to back in 2007, where you could actually get a couple percent more than the inflation rate in 85 and in the early 80s, back when I was came into the business, 5 to 6% real returns. And briefly, there were periods a lot more than that. So that was easy back then. We like this little comic at the bottom. Back in 85, it was really easy. You know, buy a 10-year bond, get a nice safe return, live a nice life, take the excess money and put it in stocks and real estate and other things. Taking the CFA exam was easy back then. And nowadays, it's really not a joke. A bond portfolio now returns nothing and will literally implode if the 10-year goes back up a percent or so. So that's where we are. The next page reiterates, I thought it was worth showing twice, that junk bonds are a guaranteed economic loss if under return to a maturity. And the next page is the main thing. It hates to be negative, but we've had to show everything in there. This is a market where people ought to be judged out. On the other hand, people ought to be pretty enthusiastic because Richard Kennelon was right. The money does not flow equally through the system. It is not neutral. It goes to some people first and some people later. Some people can pass costs through, some can't. Things that have already run up have become dangerous. Things that have not run up yet have become actually very, very interesting because they're cheap in their own right and even cheaper adjusted for the probable inflation. So we see really great money-making opportunities. And to go through that, let's hand it off to our Director of Research, Lisa Corcoran. Thank you.
Thanks, Dave. So as Dave has shown, a massive amount of money that has already been printed has found its way into many areas of the market, bonds, U.S. stocks in particular. We are looking for areas where it hasn't gone. We always enjoy looking at GMOs forecasts, and today we're at a point where the prices are so high that only emerging value stocks have forecasts of any positive real returns. Emerging markets have underperformed for a decade, and we are finding a lot of opportunities there. Underperformance was certainly a buy signal for Japan in 2000 and 2008. Everyone loved Japan in 1989. Crazy things were happening. Golf memberships were being sold for $3 million. Real estate was selling for $140,000 per square foot. Everybody loved it, and prices came down. Gravity is a real thing, and these prices were not sustainable. So the investor who bought in 2008 and 2000 did very well. Japan today is trading at the same place it was trading 30 years ago. And these companies have grown, you know, they've operated well, and we are finding opportunities in Japan today. Telecom is the same story. In, you know, the time of the tech bubble, everybody was excited about telecom. Since that time, the companies have grown sales, they've grown earnings. The share prices, however, have not done very well. Price matters. Today, especially in emerging markets, we can buy dominant telecom companies for less than book value. These have good dividend yields, they're low PE multiples, and the potential for earnings growth. An area not highlighted by GMO, but one we are excited about and we've talked about for many quarters, are the latent value stocks that we've talked about. These are the companies that are sitting on very valuable assets, but the value is not represented by today's cash flows. These are many of our commodity stocks that are sitting on decades worth of reserves or resources, and they're under-earning either because the commodity price is depressed or they have a project that hasn't been constructed yet. So in a market that is obsessed with near-term cash flows, these companies we're finding, you know, are trading for bargain prices. The values or the commodity stocks, we value them on incentive price. This is the price that balances supply and demand in the long run. What we don't know is the timing of when the commodities will reach that incentive price. But what we do know is that the upside is huge, and when it's this large, we can afford to wait. Especially many of these stocks, as Dave talked about, the Cantillon effect, commodities historically have done very well when lots of money has been printed. Oil is an example shown on this chart. The oil producers are well below where they were trading in 2014. And we're finding a lot of opportunities in the Canadian oil companies. Natural gas is another area that we find interesting. Again, they're far below their levels seen in 2014. Demand remains very strong. It has been strong for many years, and the suppliers were unfortunately not very disciplined. But as a result, the prices have come down, and we've been buying natural gas stocks since 2018. One company that we have in our portfolio that just is, it demonstrates how we use volatility to our advantage, Range Resources, used to be an $80 stock. We started buying it when it was $15 a share. In 2020, it reached $2 a share, which we were buying more of these natural gas stocks, and today it's back at $15 a share. All along the way, we were adding and trimming as the stocks went, you know, further away from our risk-adjusted value. We were buying more. As it's come up, we trim, which is incredibly helpful to our returns. We've been investors in uranium companies since Copernic's inception. Uranium supply grew significantly in 2010 when prices were very high. Prices reached a peak of $137 a pound. It is now $30 a pound, which is not sustainable. Supply is not growing. Demand is stable and strong and could be stronger should countries turn to nuclear power for cheap, stable, zero-carbon energy. Uranium mining companies remain a significant part of our portfolio. This chart and title speak for itself. Gold has been inflation protection for thousands of years, and despite the fact that the monetary base is up 9 times, the gold price is lower than it was in 2011, and the gold miners are half of the price they were in 2011. Palm oil companies are some that we find interesting today. You wouldn't know it from this chart. This is one of the larger palm oil producing companies in the world, Golden Agri. It's down despite the fact that palm oil prices were up 52% in 2019, 30% in 2020, and 13% year to date. You know, this is an area that we have liked for a long time. The demand is strong and supply is very difficult to bring on. We like the saying that it's not a stock market, but a market of stocks. There are still many pockets of value, despite the fact that, in general, the markets are overpriced and you have a huge amount of optimism in and people are doing crazy things. There's pockets where fundamentals support upside in today's money, and even more upside when the Cantillon effect is considered. So from our standpoint, we believe that investors have two choices. They can assume that the money printing doesn't matter. You maintain status quo. You continue to invest in what has been working. But to us, that's a risky choice. We prefer to use history and logic as a guide to adapt our process to account for the monetary inflation. We choose to avoid return-free risks, such as bonds, as Dave outlined. We look for businesses that have the ability to pass through inflation. We expect these high multiples to recede. We demand, you know, large margin of safety. We diversify our currencies. We own gold. We are very cautious of the overly popular. We study monetary history. And remember that cash comes from value, and value does not come from expectations. In our opinion, investors need to be very cautious of investing in long duration assets such as stocks, expensive stocks, and bonds. Long duration assets are very sensitive to slight changes in assumptions. And as Dave's table showed, we are in a world where bonds offer very little other than risk. We prefer the opportunities where the upside is very large, even if we're just directionally correct. Our recommendation is to own tangible, real assets. Own companies priced for imperfection. Own companies that have upside, even if the timing is unknown. As this table shows, when there's enough upside, you can afford to be patient and still make strong returns. This slide shows that on a relative and an absolute basis, our portfolios are very inexpensive. We're trading at a third above book value. We have a high cash flow yield. We're cheap on sales, and we're cheap on earnings, despite the fact that many of our companies are under-earning. Here is the GAC portfolio. This shows some of our activity over the last quarter. We've added several new holdings, and we've used volatility to our advantage. We've been buying things that we were selling last year, and we were selling some of the things that we were buying last year, and we've eliminated several positions that have reached our price targets. As you can see, we continue to look very different from the index, both across sectors and across countries. And we spent a lot of time on the latent value names, but we continue to see a lot of value to be found in the more traditional value names as well, particularly emerging markets. With that, I would like to thank you for your time today, your continued partnership, and we will leave the rest of the time for questions.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, press star 1 to ask a question. Our first question comes from Chris Brady, Brady Financial.
Yes, hi. Thanks for doing the call today. I see that the S&P 500 put looks like it's back in the mix here for the global. I don't know if you can expand on that, because I know that we had that before, and then that worked out pretty well when we had the last COVID correction.
Sure, we'd be happy to. In this market, chasing yield is a tough thing. Optionality seems to be underpriced. Optionality, whether it's owning, uranium stocks for a cheap price that went up so much last year when people even thought about going into it. So with options, it's not something we generally do and wouldn't do unless we find them to be grossly underpriced. Was it 4 or 5 years back now, we did notice the market hitting new all-time highs. You figure that a put option, which does well when the market's dropping, is obviously worth more the more expensive a market comes, the longer we've done that without a downturn. Fundamentals can be really good, but downturns have always happened and always will happen. Even if the market's in an uptrend, there will be downturns. And so we thought, obviously, the put option should be expensive. And we looked and were stunned to see that it was the cheapest ever. We took advantage of that. As we often do, we took advantage of it way too early, and so we had to suffer every 2 months, mostly losing on these things. We went through a long drought. It was the all-time high kept getting higher for most of another 3 years, but it's just the last 3 years where the losses were made back in 2 weeks. It ended up being a pretty good strategy, and it also gave us the cash to take advantage of a really inefficient and cheap market in March of 2020. So we thought it worked pretty well. We figured we would probably never do the option again, figuring we weren't going to see prices that cheap again, nor were we likely to see stocks even more expensive. So here we are with stocks even more expensive, and the implied vol is the ingredients become very, very cheap. So just like we did a few years back, we expect to just lose a little bit of money most every month until there's a correction, in which chain we hope to make it all back and a lot more. We don't predict when the market's going to fall. We just predict that it's cyclical and will have its ups and downs forever. And the price of that is way underpriced. If the market were to fall 20%, this thing could go up 15 times plus or minus. It's a small position. It's half of 1%. It's just taking advantage of a mistake the market's making, we believe.
Our next question comes from Michael Favorite, Kentella.
Dave, thanks for doing this again. First of all, my second question just got answered. Thank you for that. But also, it seems to me that back in the early charts showing you know, debt just exploded, we've all seen that. And we all know that demographics are kind of a headwind, you know, with folks our age you know, getting older and not so many young ones coming along. So it seems to me that growth might be challenged. And what does Kopernik think about this, how we can handle debt with what seems to be a lot of headwinds to growth?
Well, that is, of course, a very good question. I could go on for hours. I promise I won't. You know, there's two things. There's one, can growth be sustained for the long term as the population gets to 1.5 billion, which it has, and as the debt as a percentage of GDP becomes huge. Future growth obviously seems like it should be slower than past growth. So it's probably a little dangerous time to pay for growth right now. Also, as we've talked about, growth is a longer duration asset with the central bankers of the world suppressing interest rates to way below where they deserve to be. That makes long duration assets vulnerable. So, you know, growth is a nice attribute. We like growth. We buy growth when we can. There are times, you know, 1982 and 2002 and, you know, a few years back, 2009, we're happy to buy growth. But sometimes the market pays a lot for growth, and growth, as you suggest, sometimes disappoints people, especially when the starting point are times like now. So, we are finding that growth is higher priced than the market than it probably ought to be. It might work out for people, but we think the risk reward is not that good. But even more importantly, both in 1999 and now, we say we think growth is too expensive, but we don't wish it poorly. We hope people do well with growth. The important thing is not our opinion on growth. The important thing is some of these hard assets, you know, whether it's agricultural land or copper or gold or uranium or you know, infrastructure, these are things that our model suggests could go up 2, 3, 4 times from where they are now. We're happy making 2 or 3 times our money And it will be tough for some of these growth stocks that are already have $1 trillion market caps and $2 trillion market caps to keep up with that. So we worry about growth, but we wish it well. But we feel really excited about some of the values we're finding.
Our next question comes from Andrew Molnar, Thor Wealth Management.
Yeah, I just had a question. I know you guys have a lot of real assets and commodities. Do you look at rare earth metals? I know there's not a lot of companies, and most of them are based in China, but I just kind of wondered your opinion on that space.
Yeah, I'll start out, and then Alisa can add on to it. Yeah, we've been pretty much known for holding a lot of commodities, but we don't buy them because we like commodities. We buy them when we find that they are trading below that incentive price that Alisa talked about, and they are priced even cheaper on Wall Street than they are on Main Street, so we take advantage of that. So over the years, there's been times where we've owned gold and times when we haven't owned much gold, times when we own uranium or times when we own oil. We have in the past been happy to own things like lithium and so we look at all metals. We used to own a lot of nickel and lead and things like that. Rare earth metals, if and when they become very cheap, we're happy to own a lot of them, usually between ability to invest in market caps or investor enthusiasm. The opportunities have been pretty quick, so we haven't done a whole lot, but we are very open to doing it at the right price. And Lisa, anything you'd like to add to that?
I would just add that in general, what we're seeing in the market today is more enthusiasm for the base metals, less enthusiasm for the precious metals, which is one of the reasons why we continue to have a large percentage of our portfolio in the gold mining sector. Gold to us is extremely mispriced. The optionality is very, very cheap.
And it is interesting that, you know, these aren't rare earths, but a year ago how much people didn't like nickel and copper and lithium, not rare earth, but metals that have gone from disdained industrial metals to sexy new age green metals, and it's been somewhat reflected. So yeah, we'll always look and happy to buy whatever metal's cheap at the time.
Our next question comes from Chris Burke, UBS.
Hi. Yeah, thanks again for doing this. I was just looking at the overall holdings and just wanted to confirm, in terms of the non-equity securities, is that just the exposure to the put, or is there anything else that's not an equity security?
Yeah, the put is 50 basis points. There's residual cash in there. That should be it. What are you seeing?
There's, in terms of the equity securities, about 74%. Just wondering what the other 20 yeah. or so is.
In the international, yeah. So that would be cash. You know, cash is residual to the process. So we are always working various buys and sells on any given day. When the market's correcting, we are able to get bargains. When it's running up, the trims get done, the buys don't. So anytime, like a few years ago, and again now, when the market's hitting new all-time highs, it's, you know, we're effectively building the ammunition to deploy in the next downturn.
Our next question comes from Rajan Dab Holker, private investor.
I just wanted to find out if you guys hedge out the currency risk, and if you don't, what does the currency exposure look like in the fund at this point in time? What are the distribution of currencies?
Could you repeat that, please?
If you do not hedge out the currency exposure, then obviously you have different currencies in the portfolio. It's not dollar-based, right? I just wanted to get a sense of how much of Canadian dollars do we have, how much of Australian dollars do we have, how much of emerging markets do we have, do we have different buckets, and what kind of distribution does it look like? Or does it get hedged out in dollars, everything?
Yeah, we do not hedge currencies, and for many reasons. As an aside, with experimental monetary policy and by almost every central bank on earth, it'll be interesting to see how it all plays out, but we think it's not a good idea to have all of one's money in any one currency, even if that currency is the dollar. So the idea of diversification is probably more important now than ever. But the most important point is, as Elisa said earlier, it's not a stock market, it's a market of stocks. If bonds, you can hedge a currency. Stocks are businesses, and one business can be positively affected by an upward move in a currency, and another business can be negatively affected by that same currency. And then, of course, nobody knows which way the currency is going to go. So with every company, we look and say, what are we buying? If we are buying, you know, say, some of the best natural gas fields in the world, and they happen to be in Russia, we don't spend a lot of time worrying about the ruble, because if the ruble drops, gas is still being sold in dollar terms. So we're going to be fine. We don't have to worry about that. If we own, as we do, one of the best, cheapest carbon-free utilities in the world, with Russ Hydro also in Russia, we believe that a drop in the ruble would hurt us. It would be harder for those to pass those costs through. To hedge, though, would mean we'd lose if the ruble goes up. And so we don't want to bet on the ruble. We don't want to bet on the dollar. We want to make money owning a good business. But because the volatility could hurt us, we insist upon a bigger margin of safety. So we need a bigger margin of safety for a utility than we would for a natural resource company. Exporters, we think, are fairly well protected and diversified. They usually sell around the world and sell more when their currencies drop. Multinationals, same thing. Importers, we view as riskier, and we demand a bigger discount. So that's our approach, and when you add it all up, we don't view we're exposed to the currencies, but 40-some-odd% of the portfolio is in what is considered to be emerging markets, and a third of the portfolio is in Canada, even though most of those businesses have properties all around the world. And then, of course, we have money in Japan and the rest of Asia. It's pretty diversified.
Just a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. Our next question comes from Andrea Zilli, Core Private Wealth.
Hey, Dave, thank you, and it's always great to hear from you and the team. Question for you related to Japan. You guys showed the chart of the Nikkei rising, almost making up the level that we haven't seen in a really long time, but in relative terms, continuing to underperform the U.S. Just wanted to kind of get your take on value in Japan. You know, been doing some work, and it seems like there are a lot of regulatory changes, some activists that are hopefully allowing investors to realize the value that's been lost in Japan for a long time. And I was wondering if you're looking at anything particularly interesting there.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, I found that chart personally, I found pretty interesting, because, you know, the Nikkei is still quite a bit below where it was at the top, and then you put on Bloomberg, switch yen to dollars, and all of a sudden the market's back to the top. And so it's not down at all, which is because the yen has outperformed the dollar over that period of time, which is interesting because almost everybody on earth has been damn sure for the last 30 years that the yen would do worse than the dollar. So that kind of leads back to the last question. So it's really tough to hedge currencies. They usually do what you don't expect. You know, one point with that chart was people weren't wrong to like Japan in 89. It's got a lot of great companies. They were wrong to pay those prices. And the right thing to do is wait 15 years and buy those very same great companies that are distressed low. And if you did that, you made a lot of money. So that's one point. And it was, you know, same thing with telecom. And we're suggesting that all the natural resources that people loved 15 years ago, now is the time to be buying them and a lot of other things. So that's another point. But then back to it's a market of stocks. Japan has lots of businesses, and some of them are undoubtedly overpriced, and some of them are pretty exposed to currencies, as the last question suggested. And so we neither like or dislike Japan. We like the fact that with Mitsubishi and Mitsui, we can buy what we think are the two biggest and one of the best and most profitable trading companies and really merchant banks, if you will, almost private equity funds. And on them at less than book value and single-digit PEs, we find that interesting. Railroads that have monopolies and have competitive advantages, and to buy those at discounts to the capital that was invested in them seem pretty interesting. On the small cap, which isn't in the indexes for the most part, we are still able to do in Japan what Ben Graham did in the U.S. in the 1930s and 40s and buy companies essentially for free. The cash in the bank covers the debt and the market cap. And so we like those sort of opportunities in Japan. So, you know, Japan should have been avoided in 89, bought like crazy in 10 years, and bought selectively now. And that's, I think, the story with a lot of things. We think there are opportunities in Japan and elsewhere, but mostly in the areas that are not shooting to new record highs right now.
Our next question comes from Patrick Sojecki, individual investor.
Do you guys hear me?
Yes.
Sorry. So I apologize if this has already been asked because I joined the call late, but just a quick question. If you could give your opinion on Centerra, given that it's a large holding of yours and the recent news. I'm just wondering if your models include Kumtor or not. And then my other question was just, how do you guys decide whether or not you put money into Yellow Cake versus the new Sprott vehicle? That's everything. Thanks.
Two good questions. Lisa, would you like to take them?
Sure. Yeah, with Centerra, you know, one thing to point out is, especially with mining companies, the geopolitical risk is very large. These companies cannot just take their assets and move it to another country. So we spend a lot of time thinking about the geopolitical risk, and we demand very large margin of safeties when we're investing in mining companies, and we diversify, you know, our, if you look at our holdings, we have a lot of different mining companies for this reason, which is, it was unfortunate that Kyrgyzstan did what it did. And with Centerra, thankfully, they had a management team that was able to diversify during the bear market for gold. They bought several Canadian assets, and so the price today, there's upside when you consider just the Canadian assets. And so we're not sure what's going to happen with Kumtor. The company seems to have some options. Even if they don't get the mine back, it looks like they could cancel some of the government shares. So there's still a lot of upside, even without Kumtor, even with including the government share. So we like that risk reward. and we were buying when the price fell. I will turn it back to you, Dave, on Yellowcake and Sprott.
Yeah, with uranium, it's one of the most undervalued things we can think of. As Lisa mentioned, it's down from 137 to low 30s. We see tremendous upside. We have investments in large profitable companies like Cameco and Kazatomprom that we're very happy with. We have companies that will produce in the future. They're trading very cheap, and we see big upsides. We're happy on that. And then we feel a very safe way to play is to own Yellowcake and UPC. So we're happy to own both of them. They're all very similar, so we own both of them. As far as the recent Trax transaction, the old team we felt pretty good about, but we know the Sprott organization very well. We own their stock as well. We've had a lot of conversations with them about this transaction over the years, so we think it's fine. We are very happy with both of them, and we can't pick a favorite. They're both, I think, very sound investments.
Just a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star one now. Our next question comes from Dan Gallagher, UBS.
Hey, Dave. I was curious what you think of, China and, some of these, VIE companies like Baba and JD and Tencent that seem pretty compelling. When you kind of factor in, the different risks there, how huge a discount, should somebody like us who allocate capital for families think of getting if we're considering those types of securities? Wondering what your thoughts are.
Yeah, I'll give you some thoughts. I don't know if it'll be an answer. Hopefully it's helpful. We have always thought that China had huge potential. We've always thought that China deserved a big margin of safety for some of these things. And now you've got the Chinese government, causing some problems. And half a year ago, you had the U.S. government causing some problems, forcing people to sell out of some pretty good companies, and so they both add to some risk. People had no fear and were riding some of those Chinese companies to some pretty high levels. Now they've corrected a lot, and a lot of people that have formerly loved China are starting to throw in the towel. So I can tell you we're spending a lot more time on Chinese companies than we have for a while. They're getting more interesting, but I can't tell you yet exactly what our opinion is or which companies we may or may not be buying in the near future.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I would now like to turn the call back over to Dave for closing remarks.
Okay, well, thank you once again. A lot of really good questions, and these are interesting times. And we hope you're all having a great summer, and we look forward to talking to you again in the future. Have a good day.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's teleconference. You may now disconnect.